Good afternoon. My name is Robert S. Korak, and today is December the 18th, 1993. And I am doing this tape as part of a oral interview for the University of Wisconsin-Madison Archives. I believe that you people were interested in having me do the tape because of my years at the university, in which part of the time was spent in managing the Truax bus system, which was a 20 bus system that ran between the Truax housing project and the university campus after World War II. It was designed to serve single veterans who lived in the Truax project. And there was also a Badger Village bus system, which was run by another fellow named Bruce Soley, that served married couples. Normally my buses would not operate into his territory. However, I did use a few of his buses every morning and every afternoon to make rush hour trips. I was born in Cleveland, Ohio on December the 6th, 1923. And lived in the Cleveland area until the early 1960s. I attended schools in Cleveland Heights, Ohio, elementary, junior high, senior high, and I graduated in June of 1941 from Heights High School. My early life always seemed to revolve around being interested in trains. As a young boy, a young baby almost, I would push different things up and down the carpets in our living room, pretending that I was running a train or a streetcar. My grandfather, Stone, used to occasionally take me to the trolley car barn in my stroller so that I could watch the trolley cars as they went in and out. And I always remembered those visits, even though I was rather young. In addition, my mother couldn't find me one day when I was about three, and she chased around like any mother would do, trying to locate me, and found me sitting on the stoop of another house, simply watching the Nickel Plate Railroad trains going by. I think then my family realized that I was sort of hooked on trains, and there wasn't going to be any changing of my mind through most of my life. I did the usual things while I was in school, despite the fact that I spent an awful lot of time running around town riding the streetcars and buses after I was through each day. I used to visit the Union Terminal in Cleveland, where I could watch the railroad trains also. In junior high school, I was active in the band and the orchestra. In fact, I was the student conductor, along with another fellow at the junior high school. And my reward was being given a ticket one Thursday each month to attend the concerts of the Cleveland Orchestra under the direction of Artur Radzinski at that time. It was very, very interesting. And I did continue my musical career in high school, played in the marching band and in the concert orchestra. I somehow or other managed to play two entirely different instruments, although I don't know why, the trombone and the French horn. And I also could play the piano and still can, although I don't think I can play the musical instruments anymore. I did the usual jobs in high school, delivering papers, selling magazines, but the most interesting job was in junior and senior high school, ushering for the Cleveland Indians in the summertime. Probably the reason that I liked that job the most was that I could take the streetcar usually down to Old League Park, where I had to take about three different cars to get there. In those days, kids could run around and you weren't too worried about where they were. And also I could go into Cleveland Stadium for night games. They were always played there. So that I could ride a different set of car lines to get to that park. I liked transportation so much that when I was about the age of 14, I had already prepared schedules for some of the streetcar lines that I rode to and from school. A schedule being the frequencies of service and the runs that the operators would work. I had bugged everybody in the transit system for quite some time to learn how to do these things. So I marched off to the Cleveland Railway headquarters where the vice president of Cleveland Railway Company, Walter McCarter, who later became general manager of the Chicago Transit Authority, suggested that since I was only 14, why don't I wait till I graduated from college and then the company would give me a job, which by the way they did after I graduated from Wisconsin. But that's another story. When it came time to choosing a college, I applied to four colleges, if I recall. University of Pennsylvania's Wharton Business School, the Cornell Hotel School, the University of Wisconsin, and the West Point United States Military Academy. My reasons for applying to Wisconsin were probably the more interest to you. My grandmother Stone, whose maiden name was Smits, S-M-I-T-Z, was born on La Pointe on the Madeline Island, which is part of the Apostle Island group. That's north of Ashland in Wisconsin and east of Bayfield. She was born of a pioneer Jewish family that lived on this island in 1864, and the family had been there since the early 1850s, if not before. My great-grandfather Smits was the county clerk of Ashland County and the town clerk of La Pointe, and I have gone up there and actually seen the records in his handwriting, which matched the handwriting, of course, in some old family Bibles that we have retained through the years. Apparently, he and his brother owned a sawmill in La Pointe and also one in Houghton, Michigan. And they lived there, one in one place and one in the other. However, the mill in Houghton blew up and blew his brother up with it. And at that point, my great-grandfather decided to take his family to Cleveland, where they, of course, stayed for the rest of their lives. I was never able to talk to my grandmother about what life was like in those early days up there because she had died some 10 years before I was born. But she was an identical twin, and my great aunt lived until 1954, so that I was able to see her and talk to her about what life was like there. In fact, she still owned property there. We were still trying to straighten it out as late as the 1960s, supposedly in gold mines, but I'm not sure there were such things up there. Someone finally did buy all the property from the estate, so there must have been something that was valuable up in that area. Anyway, back to the college selection. I don't think the University of Pennsylvania gave me the time of day. Cornell did accept me. West Point said that I couldn't pass their eye test, therefore I could never become an officer in the Army, which of course was why you apply for West Point. And Wisconsin also accepted me. I decided to take Wisconsin, again based on my grandmother being from the state, but also based on the fact that I had a cousin, Bailey Ozer, O-Z-E-R, who attended the University of Wisconsin in the early 1930s in the experimental college of Dr. Alexander Michaeljohn. And I had heard a lot about this program, which had been dropped, of course, in the middle 30s. But Bailey went to the program. I believe they spent a year or so studying everything that was connected with the ancient world. And then the next year or so was spent studying everything connected with the modern world. It was a broad treatment of history and experience, you might say. The president, I guess, at the time who set up this program was Dr. Glenn Frank. who apparently was not too well appreciated at Wisconsin. There have been many stories about him. The one I always heard, of course, was the oversimplistic statement that Dr. Frank was a Easterner who wore spats in a Midwestern town that didn't appreciate spats. Well, so much for that. Anyway, I went up with my mother to look at Wisconsin, probably in June of 1941, and decided to see where I might live at that time, also talk to the people in the university. I think I remember having a session with Dr. Glicksman at that time, who was the Dean of Men. Although at times I think he was ill, and I can't remember who took his place when he was not around. But anyway, I decided to go there, and I decided also, since my cousin had been a Zeta Beta Tau fraternity member, that I would join, or I would live in the fraternity house. You were allowed to do that at the time, rather than live anyplace else in town. So my first year at Wisconsin, which was from September of 1941 until June of 1942, I did live in the Zeta Beta Tau house, which was at the time, I believe, 615 North Henry Street, somewhat near the lake, off of, I can't think of the street it was off of to be exact, but anyway, I immediately decided that I would like to get a job. I really didn't have to. I sort of came from a middle-class family. I'm sure my folks could afford it to send me through school, but I did decide to get myself a job down at the railroad station. I had gone down to the West Washington Street station on Milwaukee Road a few times and watched the trains, and everybody said, well, why do you just watch the trains? Why don't you go to work with us? So I became a baggageman and a ticket clerk, and that was my first real job for the transportation business. So I guess you could say my transportation career started in September of 1941. The first year, I would not say, was a very memorable thing. I did have trouble with my grades and other things simply because I think I spent too much time on this particular job. But I was learning a lot from the job, I thought. But living in the fraternity house, they did have certain standards, and you had to keep your grades up, or they had people who would simply work with you to help you if your grades slipped away or anything. So at that time, I went through this whole first year and simply felt at the end of the first year that I just wasn't doing as well as I might. So the second year, when I came back in September of 1941, I decided to live in a private house in a different place, although still belonged to the fraternity. So I lived in a house at 1800 block of Adams Street and lived with Dr. William Marsh and his family. Dr. Marsh, I believe, was principal of University High School at the time, and I just saw his name mentioned in the Wisconsin Alumni Magazine as having gone into some business after that. I continued to be interested in transportation. I was somewhat disappointed in the university itself, that it didn't offer, for its size, enough courses really specializing in transportation. I realize you have to start with a basic curricula, but I did at some point convince Dr. Trumbauer in the engineering school to let me take graduate courses in railroad transportation, which he did, some of which I took for credit, some of which I audited. But he wasn't too pleased to have me in the class. He himself was not a railroader, although he taught the courses from an engineering point of view. And I think he somewhat resented the fact that I was pretty knowledgeable on the subject of railroads, and particularly I was working for one, and tended to upset the class a bit. I spent a lot of time in the engineering school library during that first and second years, or half a second year, reading old street railway journals back from the 1880s. These publications started with horse cars in the horse car days. Reading Railway Age magazine back that far. That magazine is still published and it's been around probably for 100 years or more, dealing with railroad transportation. Other magazines were Mass Transportation. I spent a lot of time researching the standards of Poor's and Moody's utility books. I had to remind my son recently that Standards and Poor were two separate companies in the ancient days. Although today, of course, they're one company. But every year they put out a manual on utilities, and I would go back to the 1903, 4, 5, 6 issues and read them there. Surprisingly, I one day couldn't find some book I was looking for in the library in 1942 and discovered someone else was doing the same thing I was. He was a Navy person who was there on a B-12 program, I believe, at Wisconsin. And in his spare time, he was looking up the same stuff. Turns out he was from Cleveland, and Bob Blatt and I were friends until he died about 3 years ago. So you sometimes meet interesting people in the stacks of the libraries. In November of 1942, it was apparent that war was upon us, as you can well imagine, and my two cousins and I, over the Thanksgiving holiday in 1942, enlisted in the Army. I got called up in 1943, in February the 23rd, so by that time I had left Madison and come back to Cleveland. My World War II Army career was hardly anything that one would write home about. I was never in any combat situations. I spent most of my time in various and sundry schools or in training programs. I first became an infantryman in the 44th Infantry Division, which was the New Jersey National Guard that had been nationalized at Fort Lewis, Washington. Somehow I was selected to attend the Army Specialized Training Program, which had units all over the United States. Instead of sending me to Wisconsin, where one might have thought they would send me since I had already gone there, they sent me to the University of Oregon at Eugene, Oregon, where I spent 9 months in pre-engineering, taking such exotic courses as physics, chemistry, calculus, engineering drawing, history, English, you name it, courses that I would have carefully avoided had I been going to school at Madison. As a result of this, I did graduate from this Army Specialized Training Program, but they decided they weren't going to continue the program. Wisconsin accepted actually most of the credits from the program, with the exception of the a few credits dealing with English and history, which they said I had duplicated. I then went into an armored infantry outfit and thought for sure I was headed off for combat, but somehow the Army in its wisdom sent me to become a military policeman in San Francisco, where I used to patrol the streets of San Francisco and had the pleasure of living in the Presidio of San Francisco, which was right in the city. Eventually, tiring of this, I did finally apply for officer candidate school and was sent to New Orleans to the Transportation Corps Officer Candidate School. For some reason, they listened to me and sent me where I wanted to go. Eventually, I became a second lieutenant and spent some total of 22 years in the Army and the Army Reserve, eventually retiring as a major. I was exec officer of an Army Aircraft Maintenance Battalion at that time. So I kind of used it as a second career. It kind of took me away from transportation, you might say. The return to school was in September of 1946. As I came back to school, I decided to continue working for the Milwaukee Road, despite the fact that I had the GI Bill. I believe that I moved into Cronsage storms at that time. And I worked on the railroad for a couple of weeks and was starting school, of course, and maybe 2 weeks into the semester. When I was taking the train to Chicago, I got to ride the train free, of course, and I was eating dinner in the dining car, and the man at the table with me said, was Lee Burns, who told me he was the head of dormitories and head of housing for the university. And we talked all the way down, and somehow or other he talked me into becoming a bus driver at the Truax Housing Project. He needed people to drive, particularly somebody who might have transportation experience. And also, as part of the deal, they promised me I could be a house fellow at Truax. So I returned and went to Truax, and I believe I was interviewed by George Gerda, who I believe was the head house fellow at that time, in addition to Newell Smith, who was the manager of Truax. So I started to go to work as a bus driver, and I can't remember how long I drove. It certainly wasn't very long. And I certainly wasn't a house fellow very long either, although they had given me a nice room overlooking the parking lot in the front of the building, so I could watch the buses at least. Right at that time, whoever was student manager of the bus system quit one day in a huff, and everyone looked around to see who would like to be manager. There were some 20 of us driving buses at that time. As you can imagine, I put up my hand and said, I'll try it, and the rest is history. I had to quit being the house fellow, of course, but I recall some flap where I insisted I keep the room because I could look out and watch my buses going around, which didn't please the bus drivers too much. Our biggest problem in running the bus system was the constantly increasing traffic that we had to handle. The number of people was always going up. There always seemed to be more business. More people moved into the project. I have to go back a second and say that I did start school in January of 1946, not September. All this that I just mentioned took place in January of 1946. And the project had just started. There were people moving in all the time. By September, by the fall semester, and there had also been a summer semester during the war period, the place was pretty busy. I went year-round to school, which was the equivalent of three semesters, of course. We had trouble getting enough buses. We had only two what I call city-type buses built by Ford. There were Ford Transit buses. And the rest was a collection of dilapidated school buses and ex-army buses that we were lucky to keep going. I remember one particular bus bouncing along down East Washington Avenue one night, bounced right off of its chassis. The body seemed to go in one direction, the chassis in another. However, we were pretty resourceful, and even though the bus looked like it fell apart, we had it back together and running again. The maintenance was done at an old Army shop at Truax Field. Again, you have to remember the Air Force was part of the Army in those days. So anything that was done was done by the Army. So the Army gave all this to the university, which is why they had to start the bus system. The Badger buses were all school buses, somewhat like the ones I had for the Truax bus system. And Bruce had his troubles because his were probably even older than mine, but they were maintained at the same place that mine were. So his buses would come over in the morning, and he and I usually had a meeting about once every couple of days to see if we could help each other out in running these transit systems. Problem was like anything else, personnel. We had quite a bit of turnover of drivers in the beginning. Finally, we settled down to some pretty good people. We had two, because everyone was students that we used for the most part, we did have two full-time people from the dormitory department who actually ran the buses in the daytime, Monday to Friday, but the students did all the other driving. And you have to remember, we started out as early as 5 o'clock in the morning, and we're still running Friday and Saturday nights till almost 2 o'clock the next morning. So this is some of the reasons that we were pretty busy with this outfit, and we were hauling a lot of people. The probably biggest thing I remember with the bus system wasn't so much the handling of the people, the scheduling of the drivers, and the scheduling of the passengers. The biggest problem was in February, I believe, of 1947, the great snowstorm arrived. I don't think Wisconsin ever saw one before like that or has ever seen one since, but we had a terrible time getting our buses back to the garage. I believe it was on Monday. Most of them made it about 5:30 p.m. We stranded students uptown. We simply couldn't move. One bus managed to go right in the ditch and tip over right in front of my dormitory room window. We had a couple of big Oshkosh coal loaders and everything else trying to pull the buses around, at least to get them back to the garage. But it took us till about 4 o'clock the next morning just to get the buses into the property. Students were stranded, stayed overnight at the Union. Lots of exciting things were taking place at that time. It was Thursday, if I remember, later in the week that we finally got the system going. But we weren't the only ones to stop. The railroad stopped, the Madison Bus Company stopped, Milwaukee was standing still. And even though some of you younger people may not appreciate what the old-fashioned winters were like, just like I didn't appreciate it when my grandfather described to me the blizzard of 88 when it hit Cleveland. So anyway, that was probably our biggest single challenge. In looking through this outline, the format which you talked about, I've gone through probably the childhood and training part. I've gone through the pre-war, the early war schooling, the war and the return to the University of Wisconsin, the housing, the questions asked, did I have any trouble getting housing? Of course not, since I was working for the housing people. One question is asked is financing of education. As I stated, I really never had any problem. I had lots of spending money from the jobs that I always had. My parents paid for the first part of my college before I went in the Army. And the GI Bill was very generous. In fact, I recall that they even paid for typing a thesis that I wrote, which was some 175 pages. So the finances were not a problem, but the fact that I worked certainly helped matters and made it a little easier for me to thrive at the university. I might say that the last semester that I was there, which was the June to August 1947 period, I decided I was not going to do any work. I got myself an auto. I decided to enjoy the university, and I decided I'm just going to be a student, and I was going to have lots of fun, and I can assure you folks I did. You asked here in the about the buses. I think I've described that and the maintenance of the buses. You asked the question, what we use for spare parts. I don't recall that was a big problem. The buses were kind of old, but they were so simple, Dodge, Chrysler products, you know, for the most part, that we had little, if any, problem in the spare parts. You ask how many hours I worked. I don't even know how many hours I worked. It seemed like forever, but of course I was a student too. There were some 20 student drivers and full-time drivers. I did not have the maintenance people working for me. They came under another group. As far as the efficiency and the effectiveness, I wrote a very long report just before I decided to quit the job, around May of 1947, recommending that they go to full-time service to the campus instead of various combinations of shuttle service to the East Washington bus of the Madison Bus Company and various express trips. And the plan was followed through. I still have some correspondence around between Newell Smith and Lee Burns on the subject. You asked me some comments on the people. S. Lee Burns, of course, was the director of housing, a very fine person to work with. I think he had confidence in me, and I certainly enjoyed working for him. Newell Smith, who I got to know and like very much, was the manager of the Truax project itself, and I also like working very much for him. Wayne Krebs was the assistant manager. I simply don't remember too much about working with him, but I'm sure I did. George Gerda was the head house fellow, if I remember, because I think he interviewed me about becoming a house fellow at the project. The other people, Merle Jackson, Ralph Platt, I don't remember. I remember a name, Bob Lee, and I can't think of what he did, though, in connection with it. But I remember some work with him, probably on this plan to improve the service or change the service. Now, the next part that you ask is a course of study. Yes, I had in mind a course of study that I wanted to take at Wisconsin, and that was to get myself into the transportation field and know more about it. I must say I was disappointed in the professors, for the most part, that I had there, and the choice of courses that I had to get into this field. I eventually settled on economics because it seemed to be the most practical course leading me into this. It had mathematics involved with it in the forms of accounting, of course, and statistics and things like that. And I've sort of been interested in mathematics. The original classes that I had, I recall taken Spanish the first semester and having a professor who I couldn't understand what he was saying, nor could anyone else in the class. He talked Spanish and that was it. I was not impressed at all with that type of education. One interesting class that I remember, which everyone had to take as a freshman, was Freshman Forum. And it was taught by Dr. Dykstra, who was the president of the university. I considered him probably one of the most outstanding people that I ever met or heard of. He was the president after Dr. Frank. If I remember, he came from California. I believe he was a native of Southern California. He had been city manager of Cincinnati, Ohio, where he certainly was an impressive person. Even in my high school days, I was interested in civic current events and knew of Dr. Dykstra. And eventually was appointed president of the university. While I was gone in the Army, he left the university to become the provost of the University of California, Los Angeles, and died sometime after that. So his class was probably one of the more interesting. It was actually held in the Union Theater, which certainly had the most comfortable seats of anything I can remember. Like everybody else, I figured that I had every other class at the top of Bascom Hill and every other class at the bottom, but that was the way it was. Before the war, the classes were probably pretty practical in size. I don't recall any crowding or anything. After the war, it was a disaster. They were attempting to put the students in the campus with people who had never been before. They finally had to break up the hourly class sessions into sessions that were an hour long, or 50 minutes long, but you had the 20 minutes or so between classes. This gave us a lot of trouble with the bus schedule, but it was the only way. There were so many people walking around the different roadways and the sidewalks at the campus that you just couldn't change classes fast enough. And you also had classes in very strange places like the Ag Hall and whatnot, which normally you would never have gone to had there not been so many students. You asked the next part, clubs and organizations. I really was never that active in any clubs, other than my fraternity, which I lived in the first year and was a member of all the rest of my career. I didn't do much, except I did take ROTC and was interested in Scabbard and Blade, some of the organizations that went with that. I was not active in campus politics, except when I was running the bus system, where I had to be sort of active in order to keep people from continually complaining about the kind of bus service they would like, which wasn't always practical. We couldn't afford it sometimes, and have to run a bus system for everybody, not just for individuals. So I did some politicking in that particular area. The next thing is on student publications. Yes, I read the Daily Cardinal every day, and I really can't remember what it was all about. It was always blabbling about something, this was right or this was wrong or something else, but I wasn't that impressed with it. I wasn't a newspaper type person, and I had my own interests, which didn't include the Cardinal and so forth. The Badger, I remember the name, but I can't really remember the publication. There was very little set up for veterans. I don't know that we had any particular problem or ever asked for anything special other than the fact we lived in that housing project simply because there wasn't any room on campus. Leisure time you're asking about, I like everyone else, I used to get out of the Rathskeller and spend some time there, go to movies. Dating was sort of a half-interested thing in my part. I had a girlfriend back in Cleveland and rarely did much dating. Sometimes went to sorority, other fraternity parties I might get invited to. What we would do on a date probably was go to a movie or go to out to dinner somewhere, something a little nicer, maybe, or else drop into the chocolate shop, which was on State Street. It was kind of a nice place to get dessert. Next real question you've asked is recreational sports activity and so forth I might have done myself. I did as little as possible. I am not a sports person and really was never that much interested in it. I did play volleyball in the gym most of the time because I had to take some sport, but I can assure you I was not that excited about it, either before the war or after the war. The role of religion, well, being Jewish and belonging to a Jewish fraternity, I did go to Hillel. I had been brought up to go to temple regularly when I lived in Cleveland. I was confirmed from the biggest temple in Cleveland. I was not bar mitzvah at the time. That wasn't too popular a thing. But I've always been somewhat religious. In fact, to digress a bit, I recently, back around 1988, was active in a fund-raising drive to raise $6 million to build a Jewish chapel at the United States Military Academy at West Point. And finally, in 1988, we achieved the goal, and I was invited to the dedication of the chapel at West Point. So I have been interested in religion, but it's not something that I'm super active in. Politics, I'm assuming you mean campus politics, I could care less. There may have been political issues were heavily debated today. I can't remember what they were. They probably were important then, and they're not exactly important now. The prevailing attitude on drugs and alcohol, I really don't think they were any real attitudes like there are today. I remember Gene Krupa, the drummer, coming and having dinner one night at our fraternity house. Before World War II, and we all decided that he used drugs. I'm not sure too many of us understood what using drugs meant, but he was kind of erratic, and we got the impression that most professional musicians were drug users. Alcohol, I never was much of a drinker myself. However, on my 18th birthday, which was December the 6th, 1941, everyone decided to take me to the Chanticleer Club out in Middleton, Wisconsin, for a big party, because this is the first time that I was legally able to drink Wisconsin beer. The next day I had a real hangover from the party, as you can well imagine, but being December the 7th, 1941, I think I had an even bigger hangover before that day was over. Well, that's life. The sexual revolution, that's a good question. At what stage was it in your years on the campus? Well, everybody had house mothers. You've got to remember dorms, fraternities, sororities, you name it, there was always house mothers around checking up on you and lots of locked doors. I think there was more talk than there was action before the war. And after the war, the whole subject was academic. I think most of the men, at least, didn't consider that their major topic at the moment, having spent three or four years in the Army. Athletics, I didn't pay that much attention to the big football teams. I recall going to one football game, though, and it may have been my first, where Wisconsin played the University of California, I believe, at the stadium. And surprisingly, Wisconsin kicked off to Cal, and Cal scored a touchdown on the kickoff, no less. I think that pretty much describes how good Wisconsin athletics were in those days. Not something that I think I would write home about. Student behavior, you ask about. Well, at the games, I would say it was okay, although I've heard today there are some problems. But in the old days, the big rallies before the games were really the riotous occasions. They were usually held down on the lower State Street Mall there. And they certainly got carried away in those things, I must admit. There was fights with the campus police. There were fights with the Madison police. And it was supposed to all be in great fun, but it was, if you think about it today, it was rather stupid and hardly what one would expect of students who were away at school. The next subject you mention here is the subject of discrimination. I guess being Jewish, I would have probably been one who would notice discrimination more than anything, and frankly, I just never saw any. I did everything I wanted to do on campus. I was friends to everybody. I still have friends who in Wisconsin that I correspond with or call occasionally or meet occasionally, who are certainly not Jewish, but we just became friends. I just didn't see prejudice in the place. Anything I wanted to do, I was certainly able to do. As far as being out of state, prejudice against out of state students, I think some of the in-state girls rather liked meeting out-of-state people, particularly those of us that came from the East. I took some girls out who came from such exciting places as Rhinelander and Hibbings, Minnesota, and a few, or Eveleth, Minnesota, rather, and a few places like that, and I think out-of-state was actually an advantage at that time. I mean, we were sort of the cosmopolitan people that were east of Chicago. Lifestyles and whatnot, people with disabilities, that just wasn't something that one gave much thought to. Minorities, if there were black people in your class, fine. If there weren't, fine also. People with disabilities, there were a few who went around with various types of devices, maybe a wheelchair, somebody was brought to a class. But again, I don't recall it was anything that people gave much thought to. Most of the people you saw going around with crutches and whatnot were people who got hurt some way or another as students, not someone with permanent disabilities. I certainly don't recall there was any discrimination. There just weren't any people to be discriminating against. The relationship between returning vets and civilians, I don't recall any problems. I certainly knew people. I had good friends who were not in the military. One fellow just came to my 70th birthday party recently, who I've known for over 50 years. He was not in the military in World War II, and there were quite a few people like that. So I don't think there was really any prejudice. I never heard of any problems between them. Again, I was not party to them. Probably the only prejudice one ever had was that if you were in the business schools, economic school, or liberal arts, whatever you were in, you kind of had a prejudice against kids in the ag school. Somehow the idea of farmers always brought up the subject of, well, these must be hicks, you know, because they're from farms. But I can assure you that one fellow who sat next to me in a number of my economics classes and was in the ag school has remained my good friend to this day. He lives in New Glarus, and we correspond, we talk to each other occasionally. The subject of campus personalities is next. At this point, rather than go into that, I think this tape is going to run out pretty soon. I'm going to stop and turn it over, and I'll continue on the other side. This is Robert S. Korak again, continuing the taping that I started on the other side. The question came up on campus personalities. For starting off, we discussed the Dean of Men and Dean of Women, or students. How influential were they in the student community? Interesting enough, I really don't know that they were influential. I had my own personal reasons to see Dean Glicksman periodically. There was also Dean Sellery, and I cannot remember what he did in the university. It's, you know, when you're going back 50 years, some of these people kind of fade away from you. The name stays, but just what they were doing is a little eluding at this time. The president of the university when I came back was Dr. Fred. I was not impressed with Dr. Fred, I'll be blunt and say it. He had many problems, I'll admit, the size of the campus, the increasing size of the campus, and the problems of expansion were pretty big at that time. I believe he had been dean of the ag school before he became president. Somehow or other, I simply think that he was not exactly the man for the occasion. He was president for a number of years, of course, but having to compare him with the only other president I knew, Dr. Dykstra, they weren't even in the same league. Whether other students thought anything about him, I never heard anybody express any opinion about him particularly. You ask, are there any other people who deserve mention on the campus? Well, let me tell a story about an instructor that I had when I came back from the war, who taught a history course that was American history from 1860 till the Civil War, actually till the World War I. This instructor, young fella, got up in front of the class, explained very clearly, very concisely that he was going to be teaching us for 18 weeks. He expected to be there all but one of the weeks, and he expected us to be there all of the weeks. And he laid out just how he wanted us to behave in the course, what papers he wanted, how he wanted things done. He did explain to us, though, that one of the weeks at Christmas time, he would not be there because his fifth daughter was going to be born. We thought that was interesting because in those days you didn't know what the sex was going to be of your new kid, but he seemed to know exactly everything. I don't recall that I ever took a better course than from this man. For your benefit, the man's name was Fred Harvey Harrington, and of course he went on to become the president of the University of Wisconsin up till, I believe, the middle of the 1960s. Dr. Harrington, however, perfect as he was in the class, and we could never find him wrong in anything, he made one mistake in his life, because when he became the president, I noticed it said he is the father of four girls and one boy. But that was a man. Of course, the other professor at the campus that everyone remembers was Wild Bill Kekover, and the skyrocket that greeted him. Econ 1A and Econ 1B, and then I took some other courses after the war from him. They were magnificent. There was a man who somehow or other, I don't know how he did it, in what manner, but going to his classes was memorable occasions. He even ran some of the smaller classes. He really believed in teaching, and unfortunately I'm always against professors who give lip service to teaching so they can take care of their writings and their experiments and their legal side practices and the rest of the crap that goes with it. Wild Bill taught, and all of us, no matter where we were in the university, seemed to descend upon him in Econ 1A, and I think we all really learned something. Another professor that I had, of course, taking economics was Dr. Edmund Witte. As I'm talking to you, I'm sitting here looking at a paper that I wrote for Dr. Witte on April the 20th of 1947. The subject is Carrier and Labor Opinions of the Railway Labor Act. And the comment by him on the bottom is very good on the origins of the Railway Labor Act of 1926. And the grade is A-. Dr. Witte made my day, believe me, in courses like that. The other professor who I mentioned in the letter that I wrote to you people, Dr. Martin Gustav Glaser, he was head of the Public Service Commission of the state of Wisconsin. I mean, he was the president of it. He was also an economics professor. He was the closest person that I could find in the school that taught transportation. Yet he really left me alone most of the time. I told him, I registered with him for a course in which I would write a thesis. And I would go in every once in a while, tell him what I'm doing, and he seemed a little bored, but told me to continue going ahead. Well, I finished the thesis. It was some 175 typewritten pages on the history of streetcars and their application to modern transportation. He gave one look at it, told me that he wanted a synopsis written of about 4 pages of what I said in the thing. So I went back and labored away again, and I want you to know that in writing this thesis, I had actually gone home for a week to use my files in Cleveland, and my mother and my father, the stepfather, helped edit this whole thing with me so that when I took it back, I could get it typed to give to him. You can't imagine the amount of work I went through with that thesis. But anyway, Dr. Glaser wanted a 4-page summary, so I arrived back about a week later with this little 4-page summary and the thesis. He gave one look at the summary and wrote A on the paper, and I thank him to this day. Another professor that I had was Dr. Trumbauer in the engineering school. I decided that the economic courses just didn't include enough that I wanted in railroads, letters and science school courses. So I convinced Dr. Trumbauer that I should take his railroad courses, which were more engineering oriented, but had something to do with transportation. I really think the man resented me being in his class. I think he was mad because I even got there as a freshman. I think I was a sophomore by that time. And I think that he was a good example of someone who just assumed that if because you were young, you just didn't know anything. He was a pretty old man by that time. And I think it's a wrong attitude to take. I've had a lot of young apprentices myself who I've worked with through my life, and that's the wrong attitude to take in dealing with people. But anyway, Dr. Trumbauer tolerated me. He got madder in classes when I used to talk about railroads, but he kept forgetting that I was working for one and had some pretty practical experience with day-to-day problems. I would not put him down as one of the greats. Okay, then you ask the question of reflections. Everyone, sometime or another, stops for a second to see what's going on and does reflections, as you ask. In June of 1947, I had only one semester left, and I decided I am not going to run the bus system, I am not going to live in the fraternity house, I'm not going to live at Truax, I'm going to get a car, and I'm going to enjoy myself like Joe College the last semester. I had never done this before. I had been laboring with college since September of 1941. And I decided to really enjoy myself and take some courses that I might never take otherwise. So I managed to take classics, logic, philosophy, all those good courses that I had skipped all through the school years. And I found them fascinating. And I always recall both a written and an oral discussion with Dr. Ely on the reasons for the existence of God, the cosmological, the ontological, and the teleological. Something like that has stayed in my mind my entire life. They were relaxing type courses. They were difficult. I don't mean to say they were easy, but they certainly sent me on a different path. And one of the reasons I guess I was interested in classics, my mother was quite a student in her day. When women didn't go to college, my mother did go. She was born in 1895 in Cleveland. No one in her family had ever gone to college, but in 1910, my mother had gone with her mother to Germany because my grandmother was always sickly. That's the one that was born in Wisconsin. And she wanted to take the baths in Baden-Baden and Wiesbaden. So she took my mother along, and my mother went to high school in Frankfurt, her sophomore and her junior years of high school. Interesting side story on that was that in April 1912, they returned for the last time from Bremerhaven in Germany on some ship, North German Lloyd ship probably, and while they were in the middle of the ocean, the captain called everyone over to a meeting and said that there has been a ship hit by an iceberg and sunk north of us, but we are farther south and there's no chance of icebergs getting down into the area we are in. Of course, it was the Titanic that sunk as she was on the ocean perhaps 200 miles from the scene of that great disaster. Anyway, my mother, while she was in Germany, one of the teachers there convinced her that she ought to go to college. So the only person in our family who had gone to college, she enrolled in Case Western Reserve University in 1914. She had been valedictorian of her high school class, East High School in Cleveland. She was elected to Phi Beta Kappa in her junior year, an absolutely brilliant woman. Unfortunately, as women in those days did, she did graduate in 1918, but never really used the learning that she had, the ability she had in her lifetime. She never worked. She was a housewife. She did take many courses leading to master's degrees. I always remember her struggling with economics courses and so forth at Cleveland College and again at Case Western Reserve. But I just like to think of what she might have been like had she gone on and really done something with this magnificent mind she had and this wonderful education. She lived to the age of 95, died about 3 years ago, and was still interested in everything that was going on in the world. Even in the middle 80s, in her middle 80s, she and my daughter went to Russia. That was the type of woman she was. In later life, she traveled everywhere, all around Europe, Israel, Russia, Finland, Scandinavia, you name it, she went there with some member of her family or another. So I guess she was kind of the reason that I really got into all this, and why I myself got to college. You have this subject called Reflections again, and I just want to make one other comment. My career goals, of course, were always transportation. And I think that I succeeded in my career goals, doing the things that I wanted to do. When I left Wisconsin, I went to work back in Cleveland at the transit system. They did hire me, just like they said they would when I was 14. I was the 80th person in a scheduled department of 80 people, and a few years later, I was number one in the department. I was the superintendent of not only the scheduled department, but of all planning activities. I left there in 1962 and went to Los Angeles to work for the Rapid Transit District in Los Angeles, which runs the buses and the rail lines there. I was the senior transportation engineer for a couple of years. I left them, and for the only time in my life I ever worked for a private operator after I left college, a private company rather, I went to work for Kaiser Engineers and did some studies of the transportation systems in the Bay Area, San Francisco area. Did that for about a year, and then I got a job in Boston as the manager of operations planning with the Massachusetts Bay Transportation Authority. This was 1966, where I was in charge of all the schedule activities, planning activities, and the operation of the commuter railroad service for the MBTA, which was the New Haven and Boston Main Railroad operations in that area. I had a much better offer while I was with Boston in 1967 to come to New Jersey and to be the operating manager of a new rapid transit line, which was going to be a state-of-the-art operation between Lindenwald, New Jersey, going through Camden, New Jersey, and across into Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I didn't know too much about what I was going to get into, but I stayed there 16 years. I think we set the standards for excellence in transportation operation. I'm not saying it in a boasting way, but again, it was a question that many of the people who worked for us in that system are now running rail systems around the country. I have train operators from the PACO high speed line, as it's called. One of my train operators runs the subway system in Miami and the elevated system. One runs the commuter railroad in Miami. One is going to run the train operation, the trolley operation in Dallas, Texas. One runs the commuter railroad service between San Francisco and San Jose. One runs the trolley system in San Diego. Two others are connected with the system in Los Angeles. We not only ran a good transit system, but we seeded the entire transit business with people from our operation. I'm proud of these people, and I'm glad I had something to do with it. When I reached the age of 60, I decided in 1983 that I had now worked over 40 years in public transportation. and it was time to retire. My mother was still living. We planned to do some trips. First thing we did, in fact, went to California and spent a month or so in the San Diego area just doing nothing. However, certain things happened, and at the end of that first year of retirement, I was asked if I would like to become the operating manager of the bus system in Los Angeles, the bus and rail system. Now, mind you, this system has a budget of $1 billion a year. That's a capital and operating budget. It has 3,000 buses, 5,000 bus drivers. I had about 8,900 employees working for me myself. And it was probably the biggest thing that ever came to me. But I want you to reflect, all of you, on the fact that running 3,000 buses with 5,000 bus drivers is simply a numerical equation of running the Truax bus system. I learned my real basic lessons with the Truax bus system at the University of Wisconsin. And my reflection on that simply is that that's the way you get ahead in life. That's the, I owe it to Wisconsin. There's no other way. It gave me something to do. The training I got at Wisconsin, the courses I took, they may not always be something that I would remember or really need for everything, but it's the discipline that's involved in it. The discipline of being a college student, the discipline of working while you're going to college, the discipline of working in setting up a business that is just like what you're going to do for the rest of your life. So the 20 drivers and the 13 odd buses that the Truax bus system had, I went from there to, as I say, 5,000 bus drivers and 3,000 buses in Los Angeles. It's not that difficult running a system that size. The principles are exactly the same as they were when I was at Truax and at Madison running that bus system. I might say, just on a personal vein to kind of wrap this whole thing up, I was single until about 1953. I got married at that time. I was divorced in the 1963-4 period. I was separated and then finally divorced. I raised two kids by myself. I have a son and a daughter. I'm very proud of them. My daughter is a happy housewife in Blacksburg, Virginia. And my son has also been in the transit business. He's a top operating person. He worked for the transit system in Philadelphia. He is also a Philadelphia lawyer, if you want to use that term loosely, and it specializes in transit law. I'm also the proud grandfather of four grandsons, no girls. So that's kind of my life. I'm really happy to be able to do this taping for you people, and I'm hoping that you'll be able to get something out of it. If you have any more questions of me, I will be in California for the winter. That's one of my vices now. I go to San Diego in the wintertime, live in New Jersey in the summertime. And I will be available. It's 619-231-8306. That's the telephone number. Thanks a lot. Appreciate the chance to do this. Bye-bye.